Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Well, I'm really, really pleased to have two faculty colleagues with me today on the morning show, both from the Political Science Department at Carthage College, Jerry Mast and Jeff Roberg. And this is not the first time they've appeared with us on the morning show, nor the first time even in this election cycle. And it's the first of two morning show visits, which they will pay to our studios this week. We are talking today on the eve of one of the most momentous presidential elections in recent history, and we will talk on Thursday once the dust has settled and get from them their analysis of whatever ends up transpiring tomorrow. And by the way, tomorrow's morning show is something that we also did 4 years ago and maybe on one other occasion before that. We will open up our phone lines and we will invite any of you who care to call into the program and tell us in 45 seconds or less who you are voting for president, and why. And if you would like, also tell us who you are voting for in the hotly contested U.S. Senatorial race between Ron Johnson and Russ Feingold. And not that it amounts to anything in the least bit scientific, but it's just kind of interesting to see through the course of the hour as we hear from various voters how and why you cast the vote as you did. So that will be tomorrow's morning show. Wednesday will not have a morning show at all. We will stay with National Public Radio's morning edition all the way to 9 o'clock. So to give you a chance to hear their excellent coverage of tomorrow's election. In the meantime, more to the point, we welcome back to the program Jerry Mast and Jeff Roberg. It's great to have both of you here. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good to be here, Greg.
So, first of all, this race, this incredibly intense, fiercely contested presidential campaign. Is this sort of the dream of political science professors to have something like this unfold? I think I've asked you this once before, and I think the answer was not a resounding yes, as I expected it to be. What's your feeling right now on the eve of the election?
Well, I would say it's complicated in that it is interesting, but like the Chinese say, living in interesting times is not necessarily something to wish for. it's for me personally. I guess I won't speak for my profession, but for me personally, there's a bit of an obsessiveness about it, and also a lot of anxiety. It bothers me. A lot of what I see is disturbing, and so it's something that I'm attracted to, but also kind of repelled by at the same time. So I'm probably not unlike a lot of other people who aren't political scientists who think, you know, it's important. I should be paying attention to it. I should be trying to understand it. But wow, there's some unpleasantness here that is a bit disturbing.
Right.
For your listeners out there who are Grateful Dead fans, the line "Long strange trip it's been" has seems to come to mind. Dream, nightmare, you choose. Jerry and I aren't divorced from what your listeners are feeling in terms of this election. We, of course, watch all the news and read all the coverage as well. It's been a ride. I guess there's some questions to be asked, right? Has this campaign helped us understand what our U.S. democracy is about and how it works? What some of its deficiencies may or may not be. And of course, your listeners will have different views of that. So in some ways, I think it's been good for us. In others, I'll speak for myself, I'm a little concerned in terms of some of the effects, lasting effects past this election that may exist on the institutions of the United States. And by that, I don't just mean how Congress and the presidency or the Supreme Court will work, but rather electoral institutions as well, and where we go from here.
Yeah, that's really important. I think that one of the positive dimensions that we can see in the Trump campaign, for instance, is that it has shed light on the ways in which some of these institutions aren't working very well for quite a few Americans, and government hasn't been as responsive to the needs of working class folks to the degree that it ought to have been, and so Mr. Trump has shed light on some viewpoints and some perspectives and some policies that not enough attention has been given to, and yet I think he's also done it in a way that undermines some of that trust in institutions that Jeff just mentioned. And so one of the things that we're going to have to be attentive to after this election is the degree to which people are feeling skeptical, the degree to which people are feeling cynical about the country, about the institutions that make it possible.
Mm. One of the questions I have is what sort of voter turnout are we likely to have? And I ask the question because maybe it's quite obvious that it will be an enormous voter turnout, but all along the way, there have been so many sort of disillusioned voters who sort of talked about kind of washing their hands of the whole thing and maybe not voting for either of the major party candidates. And yet now, as Election Day approaches, my sense is there are not very many people at all who will not vote. Do we have a sense? I mean, are there poll numbers right now that sort of give us a sense of how many Americans will exercise their right to vote, and will those be larger numbers than the norm?
There won't be larger numbers than the norm if you take into account population growth over the last 4 years. The distinction from my view is in the types of voters that will be coming out per se. So you're right in terms of there's a lot of question of who shows up. We know, of course, that there's been about 41 million early voters across the country so far. That's about a third of those folks who will vote will wind up, my guess would be, somewhere around probably 60%, 62% of the registered populace voting. So in one sense, the tightness of the race at the end here, or at least the perceived tightness of the race, is good for getting folks out. As far as different populations, there's a number of question marks. So your listeners, of course, have heard a lot about Latino Americans and who will come out, who won't, and African Americans as well as whites, and we can break that down into college, non-college, etc. But to give you a sense, in 2012. African Americans voted at a rate of 66%. They were actually the highest voting group in 2012. Whites, non-Hispanic, came in at 64%, and then Latinos, inclusive of all, were at 48%. And then
the pattern was largely true for 08 too.
Yeah, although African Americans weren't on the top then.
But higher than they've ever been.
Yes, yeah. Certainly so. And then Asians below that. And what we're seeing this time around appears to be that Latino Americans have really been organized, and not just in, say, Florida Texas or Arizona, but across the country. So, again, thinking back to 2012, you had just over 11 million Hispanics vote in 2012. But there were 12 million that didn't.
Mm.
All right. And the Hispanic population that turns 18 increases roughly 800,000 per year that can legally vote. So you've got now several million more in the mix that could vote this time out. And so the Get Out the Vote operation that's going on among Latinos has been extremely impressive there.
Bottom line is we don't know for sure, right? So all of these are projections, and we'll have to wait until tomorrow happens for us to know for sure. And there are some things that hinge on the outcome of where our how closely our expectations are met in these regards. So,
especially in terms of turnout,
mean? Right.
And I would add to that, and just taking one other group that I have a huge question mark on, and that's millennials. Do they show up this time out? So in 08, 2012, they were just about 18 to 24-year-olds, just about 50% is how they showed up. Do they go back to traditional patterns, right? Because remember, of course, this election, a number of millennials were more Bernie Sanders-type supporters. And do they sit this one out and say, well, my person isn't there?
Or do they go third party?
Right, or something, right? So more traditional would be around 40% in a presidential election. That's enough to kind of turn the page on this election percentage-wise, again, given all other kind of things.
Well, at this point, I think that in terms of how this race is likely to play out tomorrow, their reduced enthusiasm is probably showing up in the data already in terms of polling. And so my guess is that they'll come kind of close to where, they're showing up in the polling, which is to say not very enthusiastic. I expect their turnout to drop a bit. African-American turnout is interesting to me. There's signs that they're less interested this time around, less enthusiastic. So there might be... I expect a fall off, certainly from 2012 numbers. My guess is that those numbers will be offset by a surge in the Latino vote. And so the probable outcome is a Clinton victory, but it's not certain because, some things could happen, like the African-American vote coming in much lower than we expect. A real big drop off could be harmful, or a surge in white Americans who don't have college degrees, right? Who haven't gone to college at all, and so that's been a population of people whose turnout has been, for the most part, pretty low. There's a lot of them, and if there's a really big surge in their turnout that hasn't been showing up in the polling. Then a Trump victory is possible.
Right. One thing I wondered about is, given the difference in the way the two campaigns have operated, kind of on a nuts and bolts level, that is the Clinton campaign and the Trump campaign, in which the Clinton campaign has been, not that they've done everything effortlessly or exquisitely or whatever, but it's been in many respects a well-oiled machine, an intricate mechanism, very, very well funded and very, very well organized, versus Mr. Trump's campaign, which I think even a lot of his supporters would admit is not organized in the same kind of intricate, sophisticated fashion. So when it comes to this matter of getting out the vote, is there a real difference between the ability of these two campaigns to carry out that important work?
This is one of those areas, I suspect Jeff will agree with me, where political scientists are really interested in, oh, hey, look at this. Because for the most part, there's been this kind of debate back and forth in the discipline about how important campaigns really are. And it's hard to know because for the most part, the campaigns match each other in terms of competence and resources that they put into it. And so when there's differences between the campaigns, and there's going to be some differences, they tend to be relatively minor. And so attributing the difference in outcome in terms of the election, who wins, what the vote share was, to differences in the quality of the campaigns has been tough to do. You can make some kinds of connections. Or the alternative is that the differences are so vast, right, between an amateur versus a pro incumbent who's been there forever. And you can say, well, can we attribute the difference to the quality of the campaigns? Well, they're so far apart that, it's hard to know for sure. But this time around, there's a real difference at the presidential level. And at the presidential level, there's never been a big gap. I mean, they've always been relatively close.
In the way that they've operated.
Yeah, in the way they tend to view the importance of the campaign, for instance. And so
things like allocation of resources.
Right. So the Hillary Clinton campaign has taken a very traditional view that the campaign matters an awful lot, and they've been pouring resources into constructing a very professional campaign. And making sure that they're putting field offices in all the places that one would expect to be important. And the Trump campaign has really kind of thumbed its nose at this kind of the political professional class, right? Saying, well, you know, we'll do this our own way. That the environment now is new. We have all access to all kinds of free media, and including social media, and that is the way in which we're going to conduct our campaign. And we'll just rely heavily on the Republican National Committee and its apparatus for things that we need with respect to forces on the ground. And to the extent that it has kind of built a traditional campaign, it's done so kind of reluctantly, kind of been pushed into that from the professionals on the Republican side. And so, yes, this question of will turnout tomorrow be different than what we kind of predict? We could be off. The polls could be off, but they could be off in either direction, right? In terms of calculating support, and the polls are calculating support based on likely voters. The whole point of getting out the vote, right, is to turn those unlikely voters into actual voters. Those unlikely voters aren't getting counted in the poll numbers, right? And so the potential pools, right, are white people without college educations that would turn out at higher numbers than expected, who are being missed by the likely voter model, right? And that would help the Trump campaign. Or Hispanic folks who aren't getting into the likely voter model because they don't have a record of voting. They haven't been reliable voters. And it makes good methodological sense to not put those people into the likely voter pool. But the point of campaigns is to turn unlikely voters into voters. And right now, there's a real difference in terms of the resources between the two candidates, and the Clinton campaign seems better positioned, just from a kind of neutral, objective observation standpoint, to turn unlikely voters into voters.
This wouldn't be a morning show if I didn't say this at least once. I agree with Gary. so let's stipulate that. I really do.
In this rare instance, you really do.
Not so rare.
Right.
Not so rare. And I would just add a couple of things. So the get out the vote aspect of the Clinton campaign has been impressive, and in this regard, it is much different and much stronger than Trump. And what we know about Get Out the Vote campaigns these are typically in the last 4 days, although obviously since we have early voting, right, they can extend almost a month now in terms of trying to get your folks to the polls. What we know is those contacts, and your listeners, I'm sure, have received many a phone call, they actually increase voter turnout by about 8%. Those door knocks, particularly if you can, if someone knocks on your door and has that contact with you, and then says, you know, even if you know, and of course the door knocks, the way the campaigns work these days is we know who the Democratic voters are, we know who the Republican voters are. In these last 4 days or so, the folks that are knocking on your door are the folks that are just making sure that you as a Democrat or you as a Republican go to the polls, and they'll ask a question like, oh, are you planning on voting? You say yes. Oh, what time are you planning on going? Right, to cement that idea of making sure that you have a plan in your mind to actually go and vote. And we know that particularly those door knockers increase voting turnout by about 8%. Phones are about 3 to 5%. And obviously that's gotten much more difficult with caller ID and such. And so in that regard, Clinton campaign, with all of its offices out there, with all of its volunteers across the country that are going out, and of course here in Wisconsin we had beautiful weather this weekend, folks were scattered all across the various counties here to go do this. To pick up on a different point of Jerry's, it's no secret that the GOP has had a love-hate relationship with its presidential candidate.
Yeah.
And so while Trump has not, his campaign has not built a traditional campaign as such, they've kind of said, okay, GOP, you will use your get-out-the-vote aspects for us down the road. Except the GOP, what's happened is they've said, well, we're going to do all the get-out-the-vote for lower-level ballots in terms of, you know, who needs to be elected. So the Feingold-Johnson, for instance, would be an excellent example of that. You know, here in Wisconsin, we've got Trump is getting about, Marquette Law School poll, I think, said 81% of Republicans are voting for Trump, whereas Ron Johnson is getting about 89% of Republicans. And that's not lost on those get-out-the-vote aspects as well, of folks going to the doors and saying, you know, come and vote for, the easier, you know, way to say is come and vote for Johnson, come and vote for Ryan, right, as opposed to come and vote for Trump. Again, that love-hate. Of course, there's been a little more love in the last realistically 10 days, and we can get into that if you want to.
Sure.
You know, that matters too.
That degree of commitment amongst the kind of the, we would call them the party elite, yes, behind the two candidates is real, and I think Jeff has it right. But it also filters down to the voting population too, in terms of a gap in enthusiasm. The numbers do indicate that Democrats are more likely to say they're voting for their candidate than Republicans are, and that might impact turnout a little bit as well. One final point on get out the vote efforts and campaign work: it is, in some ways, a disadvantage for Democrats who are tend to live in clustered kind of areas. They're stronger in the cities. When it comes to being vulnerable to gerrymandering them, right? They concentrate in a spatial sense, and so you can pack them into some districts and weaken their influence in other districts. But when it comes to get out the vote, that population concentration actually makes it much more efficient at getting people to get to the polls.
Interesting. I want to say one word about one millennial voter, one of my voice students at Carthage. His absentee ballot has not arrived in the mail. So he will be missing his voice lesson tomorrow because he is driving to Indiana to vote.
Impressive.
Right.
Good for him.
And I don't know if Carl Steffens is that typical, but it did my heart good to know that, you know, there's one young person who feels that strongly about this election that he will do that in order to cast his vote.
Well, you know,
and this would be his first presidential election, and I remember what that felt like to cast that first
vote. It's an important lesson whenever we're talking about large groups of people, like a whole generation, to remember how complex they are. And while we might, you know, say, oh, the young people are unlikely to vote as much as their elders, that in itself is true, but that doesn't mean there aren't the Carls out there who are passionate and committed and very tuned in to their responsibility.
I also want to ask quickly, because I don't remember, though, if I asked it of you or two other guests I had after one of the debates, but the question came up about Mr. Trump's rhetoric, which I don't feel like we're hearing quite so much of lately, about this whole system being rigged and maybe calling into question whether or not he would accept the election results if they didn't go his way. And after one of the debates, the point was made by an analyst on CNN that Mr. Trump, by saying that this whole system is rigged, could perhaps be inadvertently suppressing the voter turnout for his own supporters, because if you think the whole thing's rigged,
what's the point?
Yeah, right. I mean, it could have the impact for some of saying, well, then this is really not worth my time to get out and vote if this is all stacked against my candidate anyway.
It could have that effect. I think that I'm more worried, though, about the more general kind of effect it has in terms of disillusioning people, delegitimizing the country's institutions. And I'm going to take this opportunity to talk a little bit about Mr. Trump's rhetoric in a broader sense. There are those in the media who have been, you know, talking about fascism, the emergence of fascism in the United States. And I don't think that Mr. Trump is a fascist. But there are aspects to his campaign and its rhetoric that do, I think, raise some kind of troubling questions. On the one hand, he has built a campaign around a kind of intense nationalism, this notion that the United States has kind of lost its majesty, it's lost its grandeur, and so he is committed to rebuilding this kind of lost grandness of the country. That has the potential to kind of create a kind of a communitarian movement in which individual rights and differences are suppressed. Another characteristic to his rhetoric has been a kind of a xenophobia and has kind of racial undertones to it. He's been characterizing Muslims as a kind of a suspect class. He has talked about Islamic refugees in some fairly disturbing metaphorical ways. He's been talking about racial minorities in this country in very stereotypical ways, talking about the blacks, as if, again, there's not a great deal of complexity and diversity to the conditions in which African Americans live. His comments about Mexican immigrants is well understood. His comments about the Mexican judge, right, who was not a Mexican judge, he's a native Indianan. All of those kinds of things, I think, exacerbate racial tensions in this country. And then the third thing I'd like to point out about his rhetoric that I find disturbing as a social scientist is this kind of projection of a strongman persona, this idea that there's not a kind of a specific policy platform that I'm offering for your judgment that I can logically explain will address our problems. He just offers us himself, right? If you go back to the Republican National Committee, his speech to the delegates there, he said, "Nobody understands the system better than I. I alone can fix it." He said that when it comes to ISIS, I know more about this than the generals. And this, I mean, we can see historical kinds of connections to this kind of cult of personality, that kind of language can be connected to. And so, again, I don't think he's a fascist. And it's worth pointing out that the way in which his campaign has been characterized in the media has prompted people to explain this in the following way. They say his followers take him seriously, but not literally, right? And his critics don't take him seriously, but take him literally.
Right.
And he himself has walked back some of his statements. He's outright denied some of the things he's on record saying, or he's dismissed it as sarcasm, right, or joking. The rhetoric that he's engaged in does have some very disturbing implications, and those that doesn't occur in a vacuum. It doesn't just go away. It has impacts on the political culture, on the electorate at large. And I think that one of the things we're going to have to do moving forward, even if he loses tomorrow, as I kind of suspect he's going to, is we're going to have to address that. We're going to have to work our way through some of the more destabilizing aspects that a Trump campaign has injected into the political system.
I think Jerry has done a good characterization on the domestic side. I'll just add to on the foreign policy side. There's a lot of questions out there, certainly, that our allies are going to be asking about. And if we're thinking about traditional U.S. foreign policy and the kinds of things we've stood for, Mr. Trump doesn't necessarily seem to represent those lines. We've seen a number of folks in the foreign policy establishment say, this is not the route that we should be thinking about. And that's not to say that change in foreign policy can't happen, and it should, right, to the times as such. But the intense nationalism that Jerry mentioned has to do with, right, in terms of part of the rhetoric is what is the U.S. role in the world, and that the essentially saying they don't respect us, and we should make sure to lead the world. That does beg the question, right? Do other countries want our leadership? The world's changed quite a bit, right? So we're really more towards a multipolar system these days. You know, there was a short period of time after the Cold War where certainly we could, quote unquote, get our way. A lot harder to do now. You need friends, you need allies in order to accomplish things around the world. And some of the rhetoric that we're seeing, Jerry described the xenophobic aspects of it, that doesn't necessarily play well abroad among our allies. And calls into question, of course, we can talk specifics in terms of whether it be on our nuclear proliferation stances or NATO stances or such, but these are things that certainly there's been an intense interest worldwide in terms of our election. That's not to say that everyone's saying go Clinton, but it's certainly other capitals are having to essentially plan for what the eventuality will be either way.
When you have conservative statesmen like Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice and Richard Armitage and Brent Scowcroft and Michael Hayden and Tom Ridge and Michael Chertoff and Jean Negroponte and Elliot Abrams and Robert Kagan all coming out to condemn the Trump campaign, right? I mean, that tells you something. These are conservative people who have served in conservative administrations, who understand the complexity of the world, and they see real signs to be troubled. Absolutely. Hillary Clinton is a flawed candidate. There are real reasons to doubt her sincerity, to question her trustworthiness. Again, from a kind of a informed observation standpoint, her flaws fall within the range of your typical politician who's been engaged in politics for a number of decades. And Mr. Trump really does represent, you know, a different kind of order of concern. It's several standard deviations away from what we typically see.
Let's talk for a moment about what has dogged Hillary Clinton's campaign. And, of course, really in the news more recently has been this whole controversy about the email scandal, which sort of reasserted itself recently. And then still more recently, this newest batch of emails that came to light, it sounds like they will not lead to anything significant whatsoever. In terms of the timing of how this has unfolded, how hurt was she by that first revelation of additional emails on October 28th? Versus just, was it yesterday or the day before? Yesterday, this clarification that in a sense, at least in a legal sense, there's nothing there. How much is she helped by that, by the timing of when this has occurred?
So what I would say is, first of all, this is not certainly the first October surprise we've had. George W. Bush would you know, have something to say about that, having to do with, of course, the drunk driving, statement that came out just before his election in 2000. In 2004, John Kerry would have something to say about the Osama bin Laden tape that got released to remind folks about insecurity and defense, and just before that one. So we've certainly seen these surprises before. However, the amount of change that took place this time out was quite large compared to the others. So the races were, I would argue, mostly baked in terms of where they were going to go last time out. For the talking about George W. Bush or even George H.W. Bush as well, going back that far. But this time, The 10 days that the emails were out there, the second time that Comey, you know, since he sent the letter, really had a qualitative change on the race, not only at the presidential level, but also at the senatorial level, in the lower level races. And what I mean by that is that whatever you think of Clinton, the announcement by the FBI helped to fuel a certain narrative that already exists on her and tighten that narrative down. So for those who might have been wavering a little bit and thinking, well, I'm going to go for Clinton anyways or not. That certainly had an influence. It took the race from about almost double digits to, what, 3 to 5, depending upon where we're talking now. The complexity of the race changed quite dramatically. And then also on the senatorial level, where, as your listeners know, if Clinton wins, the Democrats need to pick up 4 Senate seats. If she loses, they need to pick up 5 Senate seats to control the U.S. Senate. That's had some pretty large effects. So some races that were looking pretty good for the Democrats are more or less statistical ties right now. And get back to an earlier question of that turnout question, right? We'll be deciding some things on this. So I would argue that these last 10 days have been quite large as far as their effect.
Perhaps. I would say that I tend to agree with that. But I'm still not quite convinced. There are some questions about the degree to which we can attribute change in the poll numbers to specific kinds of events. There is a case to be made that there is such a thing as a Comey effect. So I certainly wouldn't dismiss it. And if you pushed me, I'd probably say, yeah, I agree with that. But, this raises some questions about the volatility of races. Do we really see change in what people, what they're thinking? There's some methodological questions out there. Andrew Gelman's a professor at Columbia University. He and a number of co-researchers published a paper in the Journal of Politics this year, and when they looked at the volatility of numbers in the 2012 race between President Obama and Mitt Romney, you could see the numbers moving for up and down for either candidate, and they found that what's really kind of driving those numbers is differential response rates to the surveys from Democrats or Republicans, depending upon events that happen in the news. So when something positive happened for Mr. Romney, for instance, that made Republicans more likely to respond to the surveys and Democrats somewhat less likely to respond to the surveys. And they didn't change their vote position. They're willing to cast a vote for Mr. Romney, even if something bad in the press was being talked about. So that might be going on now. I mean, if it went on in 2012, and Gelman and others, their case is very convincing that it did in 2012. If that happened then, it's probably happening now. The Comey effect may, in fact, just have driven down Democrats' willingness to participate in these surveys. And so you're seeing some kind of non-random sampling effects, to put it in statistical language. And what is the share of that effect behind change in numbers? I don't know. That's hard to say. That would require a kind of a dive into the data. I do agree with what Jeff is saying. Some of that is happening. Some people who are on the fence, I don't know, I'll probably vote for Ms. Clinton now, might say, no, I'm not, because of the new email story. I just don't know what is the relative share of those explanations.
Right.
I think that's very fair in terms of, and we also don't know the relative share of, say, the early voters and what happened right during those 10 days in terms of how folks may have cast. The two other things I'll add to what Jerry said has to do with two things. One is, and his point's well taken in terms of how much of the quote-unquote switch that we're seeing in the polls has to do with Democrats or Republicans, quote unquote, coming home, right, to their partisan preferences.
Which is what we would expect that,
and we would expect that in terms of tightening up, and we've seen that in terms of, right, will you vote for Jill Stein or not? If you're a Democrat, will you vote for?
Sure, 3 weeks ago,
right.
As the election
comes,
right.
Against, right?
Maybe not.
Right. The second thing that I really do think in terms of the quote unquote Comey effect is if we're talking about mobilization and motivation factors. And I think that that does have an effect on
I agree with that.
Right. But how about the end of this Comey story in the sense of what was announced yesterday? Is that too late to have much of an effect of bouncing Clinton's numbers back up? Or is it great timing? I mean, just when you need that bounce to occur, is it impossible to know?
Well, it's better than not getting it if you're the Clinton campaign. the questions about we don't know for sure about how these things are impacting opinion stands. Clearly, the Clinton campaign would have preferred Mr. Comey to keep this investigation to himself and not leak it to the public that they're reopening this investigation. The act itself has been widely criticized by both left and right in terms of former Justice Department officials. And they're happy that he has, announced that there is no evidence that they can tell that warrants any other conclusion than that they reached several months ago.
Hmm. Yeah, Jerry's right in terms of course, you know, the Clinton administration, or excuse me, jumping ahead there. The Clinton campaign is saying, that this is a good thing, that it's over. You'll note that their response to it was kind of matter of fact, we're done. We're not
going
to talk about it either, right?
Right.
And they don't want, because again, there's this narrative out there on her about trustworthiness and such, and these emails feed into that.
Well, they quickly responded by saying, release what you got, right?
Yeah.
Show us what you got.
Absolutely.
And I think that was, there were some risks to taking strategy, but that paid off to a certain extent.
Right. By the way, there was, for any of our listeners who missed it, I suspect you maybe missed it too, but on This American Life this weekend, there was a very, very interesting story about kind of the nature of the emails that we're talking about, and a very, very interesting discussion about just what it means for an email to be classified, and the fact that that's not a black and white sort of term, and that just because something's classified does not mean it's classified in the sense of something we would see in a thriller movie, and that there are gray areas of classification, and in many cases emails are classified and there doesn't seem to be any
reasonable reason for it.
Not that it was a sweeping defense of Mrs. Clinton, but it just called into mind that we should not be talking about a story like this in the simplistic terms that we are.
In my much earlier life, I was a Sovietologist, and I used to work in the archives of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, and everything was classified there of various sorts that I was able to eventually see. The things that were classified, you scratch your head and you say, really? There's no way.
The issue is a complicated one, and it is a legitimate concern, right? And so Ms. Clinton rightly faced some difficult kinds of questions.
Sure.
And there are choices that she made that I personally think were irresponsible and unwise. Your point about the gray areas, when in doubt, classify it kind of approach to material is I think indicative of the complexity of the issue, and the way in which it's been treated. Right, it's been turned into this enormously partisan kind of thing. Right, it's an excuse to think she's engaged in treasonous behavior, or it's just simply this kind of standard operating procedure in Washington, and she's being singled out kind of thing. There is a legitimate policy concern there, and I think that hopefully in the wake of once this election, when things have died down a little bit, we can have a more complicated and sophisticated discussion or conversation about what policies ought to be in this regard.
Right. We just have a couple of minutes left. An article in the New York Times today talked about how it talks about how Mr. Trump has had His sort of private Twitter account wrested away from him. So he has not been firing off tweets. And in the article, they'd say, on the surface, there is the semblance of stability that is within the Trump campaign that is robbing Hillary Clinton of her most potent weapon, Mr. Trump's self-sabotaging eruptions, you know, particularly in tweets. We have seen a more subdued Mr. Trump in these last couple days. Is that likely to continue, or will at some point the cuffs come up, come off one more time? Or who knows?
We don't know, right? I mean, I hesitate to even guess how he's going to handle tomorrow, right? If he wins, you know, will he be magnanimous? Will he try to reach out and address some of the kind of the concerns that Jeff and I walked through in terms of his more extreme rhetoric? Will he tone things down? If he loses, will he be gracious? Or will he, you know, double down on this narrative that what is clearly a flawed system? We can all agree that there are flaws in our system, but it's somehow rigged, right? And thus kind of ramp up the degree of cynicism that exists in this country. And I don't know the answer to that, right? But it is one of those big questions.
Right. And it would be interesting to know how much Mrs. Clinton's campaign, in fact, has been hurt by, in a sense, losing that target that she had for such a long time.
Yeah, in terms of, you know, the Twitter account is one thing. We have seen, though, during his speeches, right, that you know, message discipline is always something that's preached in campaigns. He's been pretty good about it. Still going, you know, probably a little further than
grading
Kellyanne
on a curve.
Conway would like. but you know, and certainly the idea of rigging has been mentioned a lot in his speeches and such of the last couple of days. We'll have to see where that goes. I think the larger question, of course, is and Jerry's right on this: what happens tomorrow? And either way, right? So for whomever wins, for whomever loses, both presidential candidates have a responsibility.
Enormous responsibility.
To A, act like adults, and B, understand what they are responsible for with their various voters. They have to take that serious so we should, you know, listen carefully to their various words and what is said on behalf of their surrogates as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, needless to say, we're all going to be watching very, very interesting, very, very closely what happens tomorrow. Gentlemen, have you both voted already?
Yep. I've already voted.
I will vote tomorrow.
I'm voting tomorrow, too. I'm going to show up at 6 a.m. I'm hoping that'll be soon enough that I can get here by 7 a.m. and certainly by 8 a.m., I want to remind our listeners, we will open up our phone lines, and you will have the opportunity, if you so choose, to call us up, go on the air, and in 45 seconds or less, tell us who you have voted for president and why, and if you care to tell us as well in the U.S. Senate race. We will not have a morning show on Wednesday. We'll go with extended morning edition coverage. And on Thursday, my two distinguished guests today will be back. By that point, we trust the dust will have settled. There'll be a whole lot more to talk about in terms of where we go from here with the prospect of either a Clinton presidency or a Trump presidency confronting us. So no shortage of things to talk about. So Professor Jeff Roberg, Professor Jerry.